Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Grey Leopard Code with Gary Norris Gray. Gary will be coming to you each Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, talking sports live on GLC.
That's where it's at. From Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, to Michael Jordan and Shaq, football, basketball, baseball, and everything in between. We focus on all the major players and stories, daily features, video on demand, and black athlete newspapers coming to a city near you. Tired of the same old sports programming? Check out blackathlete.com. Sports the way you like it.
Welcome to the GLC, the Grey Leopard Code. It's going to be an abbreviated show. What we're going to do is the Congressional Black Caucus, the Black Congressional Caucus will end the show today on John Martin case. But before we do that, I'm going to get some sports news. Today in the day games, the Dodgers are playing the Cubs. Cipriano and Samardzija. A's are hosting the Texas Rangers, Garcik and Parker, and that Philadelphia Hunter Fox game with that network, BT against Lennon, also WTN at 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock on the East, White Stars of Detroit, Dragons against Chosen, and round out the schedule tonight. Kennedy Rose at the Mets, Jenny against Ebner, the Giants at Tampa Bay, Lincecum against Bryce, and the Yankees at San Diego, Nova against Ross. Mama, we got 20 more days left. 20 more days for the best time of the year. Yeah, it's football. And the games open Thursday all over the country. And the season ends in East Rutherford, New Jersey, for a Super Bowl game in New Jersey at the end of this year. Tomorrow night, the Dallas Cowboys will play by the Dolphins Hall of Fame game. As the Hall of Fame inductees go in today and tomorrow, and you can check out the speeches they make, because they make great speeches. Mr. Carter will be there, Mr. Culp, and Coach Bill Parcells will be in the Hall of Fame this year. Don't forget, the last 2 weekends in August, Michael Lewis Ingram. Go to the WZLM Radio 1450, the Arkansas Richmond, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern Time. News of the week. Well, one more month before the real game starts. And baseball be baseball again. As they throw around the possibility of a lifetime ban for New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez. Now, they do this. What about Ryan Braun, who lied to the Major League Baseball twice? He'll play next year with Bay. The trade line comes and goes. Nothing much happens. As the Orioles get pitcher Bednarz and the Houston Astros, and the Red Sox get Jake Eby on the White Sox. The key to over the American League East Division. Albert Pujols season can be over as he has strained ligaments. And the Dodgers can forget about it. They're last place in the American League West. As the A's and Rangers are battling this weekend in Oakland. First place. It's Friday. Go early with you, huh? Did you support your black business? Did you buy a Black Friday? If not, your homework will be next week to buy a black. Friday, we cannot forget Philadelphia Eagle, Riley Cooper, who used the N-word as he tried to get backstage at a country western concert. Now, the guard who was black, who was doing his job, said, "You can't come in here if you're not a graduate." Well, Cooper said, "Well, I'm going to get all you in." Well, you know, you can't say things and you can't do things like that because people are always following you, filming you. Twitter, Facebook, a camera, and Cooper knows better. The word was used in a mean, bitter way, and it's really our fault. You know, when we use the N-word, look, stop using the N-word. I'm riding on a bar train, and I see 2 17-year-old Asian males. Wait a minute. Do you know what you're saying? Okay, these two guys were 70, 80 years old. Where'd they get from? They got from us. Okay? Stop it. The NBA All-Star Game, the West beat the East, 102-98. With Candace Parker being the MVP of the game. As I said before, Taylor did not go come and gone. The Tigers started their bullpen with Quarter of a Doubt. Under Houston Astros are blowing their team up. Moving on. The Dodgers, I'll tell you. The Dodgers are on fire as they go on the road and win the 13th game last night. The 13th game in a row, the Dodgers are look out. The Giants are three games in a row now. And they beat the Cubs and won last night. And on early in the week, The Braves and St. Louis Cardinals play against each other. And the Braves are running away with the Eastern Division. I know about that already. Now, in the American League West, American League East, it's going to be the Red Sox and the Rays. The Yankees will be fighting for a wild card, if they get a wild card. The only thing that keeps the Yankees alive is their pitching. If they ever get any bats, they will be in the race. The Dodgers come back, and the question with A-Rod, we don't know yet. We're up in the air. Now, Philadelphia once again. The Phillies have a multi-million-dollar squad and they're last or near last place with the Mets and the Marlins. And you know, I know, Philadelphia is not happy with that. Last night, Bumblebon loses again his third blow save in a row. And why did they get Bumblebon? On the Boston Red Sox to close our game. we do that. Last week at Undermann with the gate open, we be slanger with a thing of ribs open. Will the real Tiger Woods please stand up? As Lao Fu, a Chinese retiger, Lao Fu, 261, as the Bridgestone International, a 7-stroke lead, and each of which is going away. And round 3 today, 7-stroke lead. MB Park from Korea is in trouble as she tried to win her fourth major in Rome. Neo Chung has got to put a crap in that. He has a one stroke lead over Mika Saka of Japan. In the Pole Bowers Tour, Liz Johnson and Wes Malott win the U.S. Open Bowling Championship. As the regionals open all across the country this weekend, check your local bowling lanes and bowling alleys to see where the tournaments will be held and the time. At the Bank of the West, Radwanski defeats Shibokova in a great match at Stanford. All these Eastern Europeans in the tennis world. IRL, they'll be raising a resident in Ohio today for on the Indy 200. And Formula One, Lewis Hamilton catches the Hungarian Grand Prix, goes into this 48 points behind Vidal, and brother Hamilton has a lot of work to do to catch Vidal. Season ends in 2 months. Lewis Hamilton has 2 months to catch Vidal. Can he do it? Ain't it possible? Alright, NASCAR. Last week at the Brickyard, Indianapolis, Jimmy Johnson wins, 300 loses, but late pit stop, and caused in the race, as Newman, a local hero, wins Indianapolis. Tomorrow they'll be at Pennsylvania, but Pocono Raceway at Pocono in Pennsylvania, Sunday. So there you go. You have the sports birthday. And this, again, what I'm getting ready to do is play a tape of the Black Caucus on the issue of Trayvon Martin and what the African-American male can do in the United States. It's very important. I think we'll go all the way to the end of the show. Senators, political activists, NAACP, former president, will be speaking about the issue. If you want to chat, go to the chat room and we can discuss it. I hope you enjoy the tape and enjoy the day. Let's continue this.
Will be with us when he is able to be free. We thank Trayvon Benjamin Martin's father, Tracy Martin, former Congressman Kwaisi Mfumi, who was a chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, as well, and we welcome him back to the Congress. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, and Executive Director David J. Johns of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. For the public service, they are offering today, in this inaugural event of the Congressional Caucus on Black Men and Boys, In establishing the Congressional Caucus on Black Men and Boys earlier this year, Representative Danny Davis and I sought to raise to the national level, beginning with boys earlier this year, Representative Danny Davis and I sought to raise to the national level, beginning with the Congress, boys earlier this year. Representative Danny Davis and I sought to raise to the national level, beginning with the Congress, serious issues that we and other members of Congress are grappling with in our districts, along with state and local officials, and especially parents and relatives, and our African-American community itself. The issues are spread across the spectrum of the life of black males in America today, clothed in stereotypes from their years as boys, as youth, and finally as men. We seek a society that does not define black men and boys, but allows African-American males the opportunity to define themselves as individuals. Today's event, entitled The Status of Black Males, Ensuring Our Boys Mature into Strong Men, cannot drill down to the entire multitude of issues that require attention, remedies, yes, and candid discussion within the African-American community and with the larger society. The way to begin, we believe, is with an event in the nature of an overview offered by three distinguished and knowledgeable African-American men to introduce the subject, each discussing a stage in the life of a black male in our country today. Their discussion will be followed by questions from members of Congress. We are particularly fortunate that Mr. Tracy Martin, the father of Trayvon Martin and founder of the Trayvon Martin Foundation, agreed to come to today's event to give opening remarks. The loss of 17-year-old Trayvon has focused attention on black males as nothing else has in decades. Overlaying the disappointment of African Americans in the verdict in the Zimmerman trial are many issues that Trayvon's death brings into sharp focus. With the loss of Trayvon, attention is understandably focused on a civil rights or hate crime cause of action by the U.S. Justice Department. Whatever the Justice Department decides, we hope that today's event focuses us as well on a lasting legacy for Trayvon Martin. Today, Trayvon helps the caucus bring black men and boys to center stage. We begin our mission to take on the challenges facing our men and boys, and we ask our fellow Americans and African Americans to do the same. I'm pleased to ask Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, a vice chair of the caucus, to offer remarks.
I'm Congresswoman Wilson. I represent Miami-Dade County, the same county that Trayvon Martin represented. I'm happy to have here today his father and also the attorney, Mr. Benjamin Crump from Tallahassee with the foundation. I want you to know that there is nothing more important that could be happening today in this nation than what is happening in this room. In 1992, I had been the principal of an elementary school for 12 years. I resigned from that position to run for a school board seat. My parents thought I was crazy. I had three minor children to send to college. I was a widow. And they said, why are you doing this? Are you crazy? I said, I'm doing it because I want to save African-American boys from the school-to-prison pipeline. So I hit the ground running. At the first school board meeting, I introduced a program for African-American boys in the Miami-Dade County Public Schools. I called it reparation for them. And I wanted the school district to wrap their arms around them and lift them up and let them learn how to be good men in society. The program is 20 years old now, and Trayvon's older brother, Javaris, is a member of the program. He wears the red tie that empowers him. So in our school district, we have a staff of 10 people who operate this program. And what we do is we take our little boys in elementary school, middle school, and high school, and they're mentored in school. They don't have to go to the church. They don't have to go to the Boys and Girls Club. They are mentored while they are in school. We take them on field trips. They travel out of the country. They go to Tallahassee. They're coming to D.C. this summer. And we have to train them because there's no one really to teach them how to be good men. So we have 8,000 boys in the school system, K through 12. We have 5,000 men, judges, police officers, firefighters, all kinds of men who have sworn to raise these boys up to higher heights. So my goal when I was elected to Congress was to make sure that if we can do that in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, every school system in this nation should have a program specifically identified for African-American boys. If we don't do that, we're just spinning our wheels. And I am so glad that Tracy and Sabrina are starting a foundation to help make some of these visions reality across this nation to help these black boys. These children are angry. They have a hole in their hearts for all kinds of sociological issues that impact black boys that I am so familiar with. So I'm hoping today when we leave this room, we leave with a commitment that these boys are not to be feared. They are to be loved, that they are to be lifted up and made to feel proud so that they can stay in school, obey the law, listen to their parents, listen to their teachers, graduate, and then we send them to college. We've sent $10 million in scholarships to children in the last 20 years of black boys. There are some in this room. They're all in this Capitol. So I say to you, thank you for coming. This is so important. And Trayvon's murder has brought this to the forefront. Trayvon will go down in history as the martyr who brought to the forefront the causes, the struggles, the suffering of African-American boys. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to ask Mr. Tracy Martin if he would say a few words to us. You started a foundation in the name of his son, Trayvon, the Trayvon Martin Foundation. Mr. Martin.
Good evening. First of all, I'd like to thank the members of Congress for having me here today. It's certainly an honor and a pleasure, not only to me, but to my family as well, to the Martin family, to the Fulton family. This definitely means a lot. First of all, I would just like to take this time to let everyone know some of the things that they really didn't know about Trayvon. First of all, when we talk about one of the greatest gifts that a man can receive from a woman, I think that greatest gift would be a son. And just to have your son's life taken away from you when you've molded him and becoming an upstanding citizen of this country is heart-wrenching. That's something that you can never get over. I always say that Trayvon was my hero. He saved my life. And not to be there in his time of need, that is real troublesome, not to be able to save my son's life. And to have his name slandered and demonized, I think as a father, I think it's real important that my message to the world is that we won't let this verdict sum up who Trayvon was. I vow to do everything in my power not to give up the fight for him, not only the fight for Trayvon, but the fight for so many other young black and brown boys of this country. I think the point that President Obama made that 35 years ago that this could have been him was so important to the American people because obviously the most influential man on the planet is weighing in from an African-American's perspective. And just to have the President of the United States comment on our situation, it really touched home. And it's moments and comments such as the President made that, you know, it sparks the conversation in every household over the dinner table. And that conversation is, what can we do as parents? What can we do as men? What can we do as fathers? What can we do as mentors to stop this from happening to your child? And I think that's where the conversation begins. A lot of our energy that we've channeled, we've taken the negative energy that has been throughout this whole process. We've taken that negative energy and we're trying to turn it into a positive. A lot of people will tell you that nothing positive can come out of death, but I disagree, and I disagree wholeheartedly because it is what we can do tomorrow as a nation, as a people, to stop someone else's child from being killed is certainly a negative, a positive, I'm sorry. And that's why we're putting a lot of our energy into the Trayvon Martin Foundation. Foundation is here for, we're going to advocate against senseless crime, against senseless gun violence. We're going to have mentoring programs. We want to try to educate our communities on the Florida statutes, on the Florida laws that really we need to understand how these laws apply to ourselves. There are so many positive things that can and will come out of this incident, and that's why we're here. We want Congress, we want the members of Congress to hear. We are the voice for Trayvon. Trayvon, there's nothing that we can do to bring Trayvon back. But if there's something that we can do as a foundation to help other families from going through this, then we're here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. You are very kind to come with Mr. Martin. Is the man who so ably represents him, Mr. Benjamin Crum. We're pleased that you could be with us as well. The co-chair of the caucus has arrived, and I should ask him if he wants to say opening words at the hearing at this event.
Thank you very much. The only thing that I really need to say is to thank, first of all of the members of the caucus, and I want to thank you for being the inspiration and part of the reason that we have established this caucus. I want to thank all of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus and other members of Congress who have joined and are, in fact, attempting to have the caucus function in such a way that we end up with not only looking at problems, but generating results. And then I want to thank our esteemed group of panelists who have joined us, particularly do I think of two gentlemen that I've worked with for a number of years, a former member of this body, former chairman of this caucus, actually, the Honorable Hume, and, of course, my good friend from Chicago, although he has moved to a lot of other different places, but I think he still calls Chicago home, and that's Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, who is also with us. And I think Mr. Johns, who has a tremendous responsibility of guiding an initiative that deals with education and African-American historical institutions. And, of course, Mr. Martin, we thank you so much for being here with us this afternoon. We also commend you for the dignity that you have displayed, you and other members of your family, throughout this ordeal. And you are a guiding principle for many of us and for many people in America who love their country, but they also love justice, who love their country, but they also want equal protection under the law. And so with that, Madam Co-Chair, please go right ahead.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My co-chair has been a leader on black men in this Congress, and particularly on black men and boys who have been incarcerated and other issues facing black men. Now, we just want to start at the beginning with black boys and then move on up and have three distinguished men talk about their lives. So we begin with David Johns, and we're very pleased that the executive director for African Americans for Excellence for African Americans has joined us from the White House. He has worked for Obama for America, but perhaps even more relevantly, he was a senior education advisor for the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Very pleased to begin with David Johns and thank him for coming to testify before us today.
Madam Co-Chair, if it's okay, I want to yield a few minutes of my time to Mr. Crump to ask a couple of questions.
Excuse me?
If it's okay with you, I'd like to yield a couple of minutes of my time. He has two quick questions he'd like to ask that will frame our discussion.
By all means, Mr. Crump.
Thank you, Congresswoman. As Mr. Martin said, President Obama's comments invited us to start the conversation, and I think the conversation starts with two critical questions. And the first question is to the Department of Justice, to answer the question, can a private citizen with a 9mm gun profile our children, get out of his car and follow our children, and confront our children? The U.S. Supreme Court doesn't even let the police profile based on race alone. So we need to have that question answered so we'll know what to tell our children. And if that answer is yes, we need to know so we can tell our children. And if it's no, then we want to know, especially Ms. Sabrina Fulton and Mr. Tracy Martin, will the killer of their child be held accountable for the civil rights violations upon Tracy and Sabrina's son? And then secondly and finally, the foundation is working to ask the question of the Trayvon Martin Act, and that is a very common sense legislation. we believe there should be an amendment to this Stand Your Ground law that simply says you cannot be the initial aggressor. You cannot start the confrontation. You cannot pick the fight and then shoot the person and put your hands in the air and say, I was standing my ground. Because there's a precedent set that will have a terrible effect on little black and brown boys if we don't speak to the issue. So I ask those questions, and I know we have these able experts to help us, but these are two questions that are heavy on the hearts of the parents of Trayvon Martin. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Some of us believe that Stand Your Ground laws are such a clear and present danger to African-American boys and men that the only remedy should be to roll back these laws, beginning with the state of Florida. I understand the difficulties in Florida, but you ask profound questions, some of them with legal underpinning. I'm going to ask Mr. Johns if he would testify at this time.
Yes, ma'am. I want to begin by thanking you, Congresswoman Hope Zordon, and you, Congressman Danny Davis, for your leadership and vision in establishing the Congressional Caucus on Black Men and Boys and for convening this groundbreaking hearing. The members of the Congressional Black Caucus continue to ensure that we have the tough conversations and engage in the hard work required to become a more progressive union. And as a result of your collective leadership and dedication, we are a better nation. I am humbled and honored to be included on a panel that includes Mr. Martin, Mr. Michael Eric Dyson, and Mr. Kwesi Nfumi. I stand on the shoulders of strong, committed visionaries and ancestors who toiled and struggled, who pioneered and who died to enable us to gather here today. And we meet to discuss developing and enhancing programs, policies, and practices that, among other things, increase black male success in education, entrepreneurship, and employment, facilitate civic engagement and leadership development opportunities, and change private thoughts and often negative public conversations about black boys and men into words and deeds that support success. As a former Congressional Black Caucus Fellow who had the privilege of beginning my Capitol Hill career working for Congressman Charles B. Rangel, thank you, and now serving as the Executive Director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans, I have the responsibility and opportunity to ensure that the administration is a thoughtful partner in supporting African American learning and development. The work of the initiative has never been more important as we consider opportunities like this one to ensure that we no longer avoid tough conversations about investing in our children and protecting them, particularly our most vulnerable, often the most neglected. And while my remarks here today will focus on early education, the initiative's mandate to close the achievement gap for all African-American children requires full attention to the education continuum, beginning in the earliest years through adulthood. Neither zip code nor skin tone should predetermine the quality of a child's opportunities. However, studies show what conventional wisdom suggests, that children from low-income families, and black boys in particular, are least likely to have access to high-quality earlier education. They are least likely to enter elementary school prepared for success. Consider that by third grade, children from low-income families who are not reading at grade level are 6 times less likely to graduate from high school than those who are proficient in reading. High-quality early education provides a foundation for black boys to be successful in school and in life, to become strong black men. I want to underscore the point that learning begins at birth, and the preparation for learning starts well before birth. We cannot solve the employment or education crises facing black boys and men and America without first ensuring that they all have access to high-quality early education. Not only must we work towards providing all young black males with access to high-quality early education, we must make concerted efforts to provide support for them inside and outside the classroom, too, extending through college completion and career entry. In the United States, those most likely to begin kindergarten at an academic disadvantage are low-income and minority children. And research also tells us that those who begin school behind have a tendency to remain behind throughout their careers. We must understand the importance of educating and developing young black boys before problems arise. And there is a tremendous amount of work that must be done as early as birth to ensure that they develop academically, socially, and emotionally, which includes developing positive, nurturing, and protective relationships with parents and adults, including educators, representatives of the criminal justice and legal systems, male mentors, and peers. Allow me to share a few facts to help put my comments into context. The infant mortality rate for black babies is 13.2% compared to 5.3% for whites. That is more than double. The poverty rate for black children is 36%, three times the rate for white children. At 24 months of age, black babies score significantly lower than white babies on cognitive assessments. And at about age four, 28% of black children were proficient at letter recognition, compared to nearly 40% of white kids. 55% of black children were proficient at number and shape recognition, compared to more than 70% of white children. From the time of conception to the first day of kindergarten, development proceeds at a pace exceeding that of any other subsequent period of life. And as Harvard professor Jack Schoenkopf reminds us, nurturing and responsive interactions build healthy brain architecture that provides a solid foundation for later learning, behavior, and health. Simply stated, access to high-quality early education for African-American boys especially can be the difference between a pathway that leads to the White House and one that leads to the jailhouse. High-quality early education can be used to overcome cognitive and non-cognitive challenges facing black boys, including the absence of a father, exposure to violence, and disproportionate representation in detention and special education programs. African-American children who participate in early Head Start have higher receptive vocabularies, display less aggressive behavior, report lower levels of bullying, and score higher on math and reading assessments in elementary school than African-American children that do not participate in these programs. Gains persist through adulthood as children who attend high-quality preschool programs are more likely to graduate from high school prepared to take full advantage of the global 21st century marketplace after successfully completing college. Parents, families, and communities also benefit from high-quality early education. African-American parents with children who participate in high-quality programs have better language and literacy environments, emotionally supportive parenting, and show higher levels of support for education in the home. The first step to ensuring that black boys grow into strong men is giving them access to high-quality early education. And to accomplish this, the initiative is working with members of the faith-based and early education advocacy communities to raise awareness among parents and families about the importance of investing during these most critical years. We are working with community-based organizations to ensure that parents and families can identify and have access to high-quality programs. We are undertaking efforts to afford African-American children exposure to science, technology, engineering, the art, agriculture, and mathematics, our STEAM programs and concepts early and often. And we are also working with publishers to produce books and content that reflect the language, culture, and heritage of black kids to ensure that they develop vocabulary and pre-literacy skills needed to make the critical transition from learning to read to reading to learn. And in what follows, I will outline a few critical opportunities that we have to invest in early opportunities for black men. The first is home visiting. Voluntary home visiting programs match parents with trained professionals to provide information and support during pregnancy and throughout a child's first years of life. Quality home visiting programs lead to fewer children in social welfare and juvenile detention centers as well as mental health facilities. It also provides considerable cost savings for states. With the support of Congress, we have invested $1.5 billion to expand home visitation programs that can provide black boys with the services and educational support needed to improve health, development, and ensure their ability to learn, and we must simply invest more. Home visiting programs provide critical support to young expecting mothers like my sister, who after becoming pregnant in high school needed the counsel and support of trained professionals who could assist her and my mother in creating the type of environment that optimizes early life opportunities for young children like my niece Jordan. By supporting African-American mothers, fathers, and communities and understanding how important it is that we invest in young children beginning at birth, and by equipping black families with the information and resources needed to access high-quality early education, we can make sure that the earliest steps black boys take prepare them for a life of success. Two is child care. In the United States, more than 11 million children under the age of five are in some type of child care arrangement each week. On average, children of working mothers spend 35 hours a week in child care, many with multiple providers to allow parents opportunities to work during both non-traditional and traditional work hours. Child care is an essential work support, which also provides opportunities to develop foundational skills in young children. However, for too many African-American boys, the extreme costs associated with high-quality child care result in lost opportunities to develop the tools needed to begin school ready to learn. By age five, 56% of low-income black kids are not prepared for kindergarten, and these gaps only widen when black boys miss out on early opportunities. Unlike the K-12 public education system, which is financed mostly by federal, state, and local governments, the cost for child care is largely borne by parents and families. The economic crisis, high cost of child care, and barriers in state laws frequently lead many parents to pursue non-center-based methods of informal care, such as leaving their babies with grandparents, families, and other caring adults. And for those who pursue center-based facilities, the cost can be an extreme burden. The average cost of infant child care licensed center exceeds the cost of public college tuition and related fees in 36 states throughout this country. Nationally, the cost for full-time child care for infants ranges from 7 to 16% of the median income for a married couple. For single parents, the cost of center-based infant care exceeds more than 10% of their income. More must be done to subsidize the cost of high-quality child care for parents who cannot afford such programs because they are unemployed or underemployed, working jobs that do not provide them with family-sustaining wages or opportunities for advancement. In addition to cost and accessibility, the following must be addressed to ensure that more black boys have access to high-quality child care programs and services. Improving safety, increasing awareness and parent, family, and community engagement to ensure that parents, especially young parents, have the information they need to access these programs, and adjusting federal reimbursement rates to account for the actual cost of providing care while increasing federal, state, and local supports more generally. The third is Head Start and Early Head Start. Head Start and Early Head Start circumvent the high cost of quality early education by providing federal support to programs that agree to serve low-income, disadvantaged children and their families. The program covers costs for families that meet certain income eligibility criteria, particularly families that would otherwise fail to enroll children in center-based programs. A recent study of Head Start found that the program had a positive, statistically significant impact on children's preschool experiences, school readiness, language, and vocabulary skills. Black children were reported to have reduced inattentiveness, fewer problems with structured learning, peer interactions, or teacher interactions. They also had better relationships with teachers. And while the long-term effects of Head Start deserve additional research, the program's ability to close gaps and prepare low-income minority children for kindergarten is difficult to deny. For decades now, Head Start has improved life opportunities for black boys. And while we celebrate the success of Head Start, it is imperative that we give more black kids access. In 2012, Head Start served less than 40% of eligible children, roughly 300,000 black kids. Early Head Start currently serves fewer than 4% of all eligible infants and toddlers.
Mr. Johns, are you nearing the end of your testimony?
Yes, ma'am. Much more needs to be done to increase investments in this area. And while I have summarized some of the challenges facing black boys during the earliest years of life, I want to ensure that our conversations are focused on solutions, on underscoring the opportunities we have to make investments that result in success for black men and boys. In the coming months, the initiative will continue to facilitate critical conversations in the following areas. One, raising awareness of and increasing opportunities to access programs that enhance education, employment, and entrepreneurship for black men and boys. We need to increase the number of black educators, discuss the impact that sociocultural factors like trauma and toxic stress have on learning and development, and strengthen the relationships that parents and mentors have with students in schools to improve achievement and support development. Two, we will ensure that all caring adults are engaged in supporting black male success, whether volunteering to host activities to provide black boys with an opportunity to develop academic or social skills, or leveraging technology to ensure that black kids have access to civic engagement and leadership development opportunities. And finally, we will take on the essential task of changing the way that we talk about black boys in public and in private, as we have modeled here today. We must ensure that what we say and how we demonstrate our support for black men and boys is aligned with ensuring that they are and that they feel valued, supported, and protected. And while we must be careful not to generalize and suggest that all black boys are in crisis, all black men can benefit from knowing that they are loved, valued, supported, and protected, especially at home and in their communities. And to do this, we must ensure that we are doing all we can to develop their skills, to create protective, safe environments. And this requires correcting myths that give life to fallacies that black boys cannot achieve at extremely high levels in spite of generations of brothers who have done exactly that. We must dispel myths like there are more black men in prison than in college. You see, when I worked as a classroom teacher, some of my colleagues used that myth to convince themselves that they didn't have to do the tough work of investing in young black boys because we all end up dead or in jail. Changing the narrative around black boys requires telling more stories about everyday examples of achievement and success, of resilience and grit. It should not be the case that we celebrate single events like Tim King sending an entire class of black boys to college, not only because the work that educators at Urban Prep accomplish is tremendous, but also because there are countless schools who have figured out how to nurture and support black boys. We should tell stories each and every day about the many ways that black boys are excelling and innovating, giving support to their families, their schools, and their communities. We must talk about opportunities to optimize these chances for black men of all ages to support each other and to support boys younger than they are. And we have to continue to have conversations in public and in private about opportunities and obligations we have as a nation to be inspired by the grace of the Trayvon Martin family. We have to talk about it. And we have to support programs and people in our community who are doing the work of saving our sons, beginning early. Beyond simply talking about it, we must ensure that we move past the rhetoric to ensure that these gains are made. And as we do this work, it's also important that we not neglect our daughters in the process, because our black girls and women need our care, love, and support too. These are but a few of the ways in which the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence is engaging in this work. I look forward to identifying ways that we can work further to support black men and boys throughout this country for generations to come. Our boys need us to do this work, and the collective economic, social, and national security of our great nation requires it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. John. Our next presenter, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, who is an American Book Award recipient and 2 times the NAACP Image Award winner, is one of the nation's most influential and renowned public intellectuals. He has been named one of the 150 most powerful African Americans by Ebony Magazine. The Philadelphia Weekly contends that Dr. Dyson is reshaping what it means to be a public intellectual by becoming the most visible black academic of his time. Dyson has also authored and edited 18 books pertaining to African-American leaders, racial profiling, and racial relations in America. Currently, Dr. Dyson is a sociology professor at Georgetown University and has previously taught at some of the nation's most prestigious universities, including Brown, Chapel Hill, Columbia, and the University of Pennsylvania, primarily on topics regarding issues affecting black youth and the future of the black community given the current social, economic, and political conditions. Dr. Dyson.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Congresswoman Norton and Congressman Davis for convening this panel. Even before the verdict, it should be announced. And with that kind of prescience and that kind of insight about why we are confronting the issues that we are confronting here today. And to all of the distinguished colleagues here in Congress, and of course to Mr. Johns for that great comment, and Attorney Crump and Mr. Martin for their courage and their valor, and Mr. Nfume for his sharp insight. I want to talk about young men, teens, and youth. I myself was a teen father, lived on welfare for 3 years, didn't go to college until I was 21. So I understand some of the existential drama that attaches to black boys, males, and men who have been particularly subject to the arbitrary stigma and pathology that attaches to young men in American society, but leave aside the incredible valor and the vitality of their struggles to claim decent spaces in American society. What do teens who are black and male face in our culture? Well, let's be honest. There's a cultural backdrop. All black people live under suspicion. Trayvon Martin is but the most ready and apt metaphor for the suspicion to which we are subject. Black humanity has been suspected from the beginning of our sojourn in American society. I don't need to give a history lesson about that. The great Thomas Jefferson, the architect of Monticello and the Declaration of Independence, also wrote notes on Virginia, where he questioned the cerebral abilities and the intellectual acuity and the reason of black people, even as at night, retiring from his study, engaged in relations with a young woman whose loins trapped his logic. So that the reality of our humanity being under suspicion is critical as the backdrop to understand the unfolding and evolving perception of black people in America. Our humanity has been questioned, and our intelligence has been questioned. As a result of that, black teens inherit a culture where the suspicion and skepticism about their humanity and their intelligence are part and parcel of what we deal with on the daily. This is why, for instance, to echo Mr. Johns, we not only talk about black male stereotypes, we talk about black female stereotypes, because had Rachel Gentile been believed, had the stereotypical representation that articulates her as somehow subhuman, and not just from white Americans, but black too, skeptical about what she is, speaking three languages, perhaps her testimony would have been believed and the outcome of the trial could have been shaped, because black women are under vicious assault as well, and as a result of that, mothers mired in poverty help young black men come to birth, and both of them receive the calumny and the slander of this culture. So young teens inherit a culture that unconsciously and consciously engages in the skepticism and suspicion of their existence. The educational system into which they are thrust expels them at a rate 2.5 times greater than their white peers. So you in school and you get kicked out for stuff that your white peers don't. Not only that, they are subject to detention and also put in special education programs that target them specifically as being less capable intellectually. What happens then is that they are also subject to the criminal justice system through nonviolent drug offenses. Even though the self-reporting of young white people suggests they do drugs about the same rate, if not a little bit more, than do black and other kids, it stands to reason. If you got more disposable cash, you got more time and capacity and ability to engage in nefarious activities on the extra legal sense. So the point is that white kids are doing drugs in the same way black kids are, but white kids are not being put in jail because they are not suspected. But because they are not viewed as likely to engage in that kind of behavior, they are not profiled. And so young black men, teens in general, are profiled, not just by the police department, when they go into stores. Retail profiling, you ain't got to be a teen to be subject to that. I got a black card, and yet I'm profiled. Though I painted it last night, it was green. But the point is that we are subject to that kind of racial and retail profile. The disproportionate number of black males who are put in the criminal justice system suggests to us that there is a targeting of African-American men, particularly teens, beginning in the 14, 15, 16-year age range, that makes them subject to adult penalties in the criminal justice system. Many of these kids are tried as adults, and the book, so to speak, of the law is thrown against them, even for first-time offenses. And then even more broadly, stereotypes of black male and youth identity. We could have an empirical crush to verify the assault of the state upon vulnerable black people, but I want to weave a narrative and tell a story to make you feel the compelling character of the assault on young black teens. The reality is these stereotypes are out there. Even noted Washington Post columnists say that, let's be honest, the hoodie is the uniform of the criminal. Not for Mark Zuckerberg, not for Bill O'Reilly, not for Gerardo, all of whom, with the exception of Mr. Zuckerberg, have assaulted black people and black teens for being engaged in the self-perpetuation of a legacy of assault upon them because of the clothing they wear. So that this sartorial profiling, this clothing profiling, suggests that black people can't even dress with the same kind of freedom that our white peers do, and in this case, young black teens can't because they will be automatically assumed to be a thug. Now, some people say, well, it's your problem. It's hip-hop culture. Hip-hop created this. Really? Before the rise of hip-hop culture 30, 35 years ago, black men were being profiled. Black teens were being seen as preternaturally given to inclinations to be criminal. So excuse me, that's not the case. Now, has some element of hip-hop culture glorified and reinforced the devaluing of black life? Of course it has. But it's also spoken against it. Tupac said just the other day, I got lynched by some crooked cops, and to this day, them same cops on the beat getting major pay, but when I get my check, they taking tax out, so we paying the cops to knock the blacks out. Jay-Z said, God forgive me for my brash delivery, but I remember vividly what these streets did to me. Picture me allowing these clowns to nitpick at me, portray me like a pickaninny. So they are combating the vicious misrepresentation of black masculine identity by resorting to the very violence that is critical to American culture and American identity, and the sense of machismo that young black people appropriate has been given to them by a culture that creates laws like Stand Your Ground. And that creates a gun industry that is obsessed to a nearly erotic intensity with guns as the manifestation of their manhood. They ain't invented the game. They plan it in their own way. So the reality is, how do we deal with the stereotypical representations of young black people? And now our friends on the right suggest it's black-on-black crime. Where you been? We've been talking about that. When Newtown happens, cameras are there. When Aurora happens, cameras are there. When Chicago happens, cameras are not there. But now we pathologize those young black people. And by the way, black people have been marching from time immemorial against the vicious legacy of white supremacy that occupies black minds, that leads us to kill each other, to hate each other, to despise the very presence that we represent. So we know about black-on-black crime as a reflection of a broader pathology, and both of them must be arrested. But the reality is politicians don't show up from the White House down to the local level when black children's bodies are at stake. And when they do show up, they give us lectures about black family structure when we can look at most white people who commit crimes, and they have obviously familial challenges that need to be articulated. And black-on-black crime, true, 94% of black people who are murdered by black people, but 86% of white people are murdered by white people. White-on-white crime is a reality in America today, but not assumed as such. So black teens are facing a state that stigmatizes them, a culture that demonizes them, a pop culture that both expresses their intent to be greater than they are, but reinforces some of their vulnerability. And so I would suggest then that what we do are a few things. First of all, the educational system has to be taken seriously as a locus classicus for the battles we need to wage. And how do we do that? We got to stop demonizing and stigmatizing our children. We've got to create alternative structures to admit multiple forms of learning. People learn in multiple ways. I mean, Jay-Z is a high school graduate. Tupac dropped out. Nas, eighth grade dropout. Yet these are rhetorical geniuses. Who's wrong? The school or them? There's a difference between learning and education on the one hand and schools on the other. Schools are the institutional matrices that articulate our expression to educate each other and hold each other accountable. Learning is about the desire to be educated for a lifetime. And so we have to converge these two disparate meanings in some instances, figure out ways to acknowledge our children's learning styles, not to stigmatize and demonize them. Don't send them to jail if they have a behavioral challenge, and figure out ways not to put them into detention, which becomes a feeding cell to jail, which becomes a warehouse for prison. Secondly, we've got to reduce the penalties for nonviolent drug offenses and for zero-tolerance policies. Now, we are not here to have affirmative action for thugs, so to speak. We are here to say that everybody doing it, everybody ought to be taken in the same way to jail, or everybody should be given a break. Born poor and black, born with your back against the wall, many people, the President of the United States, in his brilliant memoir, talks about abusing marijuana. So had he been caught, put in jail, stigmatized, he'd have been a well-achieving young man, I'm sure. But he might have been standing on the sideline going, you know what, I could have been president. Yeah, right. So the reality is we have to be very careful how we stigmatize our youth, and the public policies that we put in place and the laws must not unnecessarily, unduly, and disproportionately stigmatize those children. Thirdly, the president made a remarkable statement on race, finally, and it is good that the president stood up. It was a result of pressure. We understand that. He said, initially I said, Trayvon could have been my son. But look at the metaphorical and analogical shift he made. He said, but no, I could have been Trayvon. And I would add, if I was the speechwriter for Mr. Obama, let me Dysonize that. Not only could you have been Trayvon 35 years ago, you're Trayvon now. Right? Why? And I'll end. Because they are profiling Mr. Obama in the White House, asking about your transcripts from a man whose hair is thinner even than his skin, questioning you, trumping you in a very serious and vicious fashion, from people asking to see your birth certificate as if you're not American. You did it the way people said they wanted it to be done. You went to Columbia, graduated, Harvard Law School, and graduated. You don't wear a hood. It can't be about a hoodie. It can't be about the demonization of a certain kind of sartorial choice. It is about the way in which black masculinity expresses a menace and a threat in American culture, both consciously and unconsciously, that needs to be decoupled in the collective imagination of America. And then finally, when we see these as structural problems, when we see that young girls are being demonized, put in prison more often as well, subject to the kind of vicious stereotypes that I talked about in regard to Rachel Gentile, and that they, along with young black boys, are the recipients of the outrageous indignity of being assumed not to be intelligent and not to be human. And so as I close, my plea and prayer is that as we craft social and public policy, we ask the White House to once again be a bully pulpit. Mr. Obama wrote one of the most brilliant memoirs on race we have. It would be like Michael Jordan was in the White House but couldn't talk about basketball. Mr. Obama is acutely sensitive and keenly informed about the complicated matter, and the speech he delivered the other day was yet but a beginning. Now we need him and others to use their spots, spaces, and spirits in this culture to not only edify the conversation and to inform the analysis, but at the end of the day, to recognize that young black teens are children of God who deserve every protection, because if those women on the jury understood Trayvon as their child, they may have felt his blood calling from the ground where George Zimmerman laid him to his rest.
Thank you, Dr. Dyson. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you Khaleesi Mfume. He was born, raised, educated, and eventually taught as a professor at Morgan State University in the city of Baltimore. It was in Baltimore that he made the decision to follow his dreams of impacting society and help shape public policy. At the age of 38, he was elected to the United States Congress and served terms during the presidencies of Reagan, Bush Sr., and Clinton. As a member of the House of Representatives, Congressman Mfume served as a member of the Committee on Education and helped to impact commerce and industry matters as a senior member of the Small Business Committee. Congressman Mfume also served as both vice chair and later chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Khaleesi Mfume left his congressional seat to become president and chief executive officer of the NAACP in February of 1996, after being unanimously elected to the post. He served there in this capacity for 9 years. During that time, Mfume significantly raise the national profile of the NAACP while helping to restore its prominence among the nation's civil rights organizations and university. Mr. Kawisi Mfume.
Thank you very, very much, Congresswoman, and my thanks to all who've gathered here. I really want to just, on a point of personal privilege, express my full thanks to the full caucus, many of you whom I've served with throughout the course of time. We've traveled the world. We've fought on issues together. And I fervently believe that this group is one of the ablest groups of legislators that this nation has produced. You serve a valuable service, and having worked with you and fought with you side by side on a number of issues, I have nothing but absolute respect for you all. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I appreciate the convening. I also want to say that as a father of six men and a grandfather of four boys, I have a particular sense of brotherhood with Tracy Martin. We all know a parent's worst nightmare is to have to bury your child. It's supposed to be the other way around. And so I just want to say on behalf of parents everywhere that you have really comported yourself, you've really taken this and kept your grace, your dignity, your manhood, and that you and Sabrina ought to be commended for giving us because of me. I want to see you grow up one day and do what I can't do. I want you to believe that the world has changed. It's the sense that parents every day get up with, and it's through the simple eloquence of your example that parents everywhere, regardless of race, understand differently as you do about what it's like to have something tragic happen to you like this. And while it hasn't happened to us, we all stand with you. Madam Chair, I'd like to do a couple of things. I want to thank both of my panelists for their presentations. Michael and I have known each other for a long, long time and worked together on a lot of stuff. And I can't think of a better person from the White House to come down and to share this than you. And I really, really do mean that. Let me just, if I might, I know it's the evening is starting to roll on. I want to talk to you a bit about the manhood side. You know, childhood, boyhood, adolescence, manhood. And I would really be doing a disservice if I didn't just simply say a couple of things that color, for me at least, manhood. I grew up, like maybe some of you, in a different kind of America. It was a very segregated America with legal laws. And I sat on the back of the bus. That's the way it was. If my family needed a sandwich and we were on the road and we stopped, we'd go to the back of the restaurant. They would open the screen door and they would hand us something in a brown bag. It was considered normal in America. When I needed shoes, my mother had to put my foot on a brown bag and draw a line around it and cut it out and take that to the store because they wouldn't let black kids into the store to try anything on. I went to segregated schools, drove by white schools on the way to those segregated schools that were dilapidated and run down. A lot has changed since then. The one thing that hasn't changed is the color of my skin. And as people had their own preconceived notions about me back in the 50s about who I was and what I would become, that unfortunately is why we are all here today. When Emmett Till got viciously murdered,
I was in the first grade. It was a week after that, the first time that I was ever called the word nigger from the back of a pickup truck with people who threw something at me and laughed as they went by. What pains me is that I fear one day that even my grandsons will be called the same thing, not because they've done anything at all, but because, unfortunately, people still, some people, harbor these sort of feelings. In those days, like I hope these days, and that's why I wanted to say what I said about Mr. Martin, we were taught basic values. You work hard, play by the rules, love your country, cherish your faith, respect your elderly, comport yourself in a way that says that you, in fact, have some dignity about who you are and that you really care about what's going on. My mother, like her mother, lived and died in poverty. My father, like his father, lived and died in poverty. My sisters and I were taught that while we were living in poverty, the poverty should never live within us, that there was a way to tap into something different. And we see that in young people every day, despite what they are going tap in. They just want to be able to live on so that that can be magnified, so they can improve their lives, so they can do what they have to do. My mother, health care, had a number of diseases, died in my arms when I was 16 years of age. Didn't find out who my real father was until that same night. I dropped out of school 2 weeks later, took odd and end jobs to try to find a way for my sisters, who were younger than me, and I to survive. Worked menial jobs, got angry like a lot of black men do. When I would look at the TV screen and see Ozzie and Harriet and all these great things about family and turn it off and look at the 6x9 room that I lived in for 6 years following my mother's death. That kind of anger is still with us because we've not provided the explanations to young people about why their circumstance is so very different from what they see on Dancing with the Stars and on all these other shows where there's this great energy and the great belief that everything is well. And yet we know that everything is not well. Became a teenage parent, joined a gang, and remained angry at a society that I could not understand. I only wanted to tell you this because all of us have a story. All of us have a testimony, whether you're my age or much younger. Unfortunately, if you are black in America, male or female, we've got a testimony and we have a story. And so as we get through childhood and boyhood, and we get through the adolescence and all the things that Michael was talking about, how we get castigated by our society that doesn't know us yet. One day, if we're lucky, we realize, as men at least, that we've made it to manhood. And then when we get there, we realize that there are some things that automatically happen. Realization, reaffirmation, and then reclamation. The realization will hit all of us as it did real fast because you realize that you made it through. And you can count on your hands and your toes on a blackboard how many people like you did not. They're nameless and faceless, but they grew up with you. They were a part of your generation, and for whatever reason, they're either in the criminal justice system facing life, they're in a hospital ward unable to take care of themselves, or they are dead. And when you realize that I made it, you also realize that I don't have the luxury of failing. We know that unemployment for African-American men is at 19%. If it were that for any other group in this country, people would be trying to close down the nation's capital to find out answers. You know better than I, and many of you have said this publicly in your districts and elsewhere. Why is it that unemployment among African-American teens is at 40%. Unheard of, unacceptable, no redemption there at all. And people talk about, oh, we just don't understand, and why can't they realize that this is an opportunity society? No, you can't realize that when you can't even find a way to help yourself. Our public schools are overcrowded and ill-equipped. In some of those schools, drugs are more available than textbooks. And young people being promoted because of their age or their size, as if that's going to get them to the point where they need to be to arrive on graduation day all dressed up with no place to go. in higher education, and I want to thank the caucus for fighting for the Parent Plus program. Parents need to be able, when they can, to provide a way for those kids to get an education. I'm working with 700 freshmen now at Morgan State University. You know what the biggest peer is? It's the other 700 that couldn't make it because their families couldn't afford it because of the things that happened with Parent Plus and because of the high rate of finance that's attached to loans in college. We've got mandatory minimums that take away judicial discretion, no matter what the issue was, and people are getting crazy sentences because judges are locked in as a result of legislation to mandatory minimums, absent discretion, where you just got to send somebody away for an extremely long period of time, and you've got to do this and you've got to do that. We all know about the disparities in crack cocaine, the disparities in marijuana busts, the disparities in how you get sentenced if you did something to a black person versus how you did something to someone else in our society. That's all been documented. And so this realization sits in, and it's like, you know, I guess I am lucky, and I guess I am blessed, but what do I do? And what the first thing I think that happens is that we are reaffirmed to ourselves as men when we get to that stage. Until the day I die, I'm going to make my body a bridge so that somebody can run across it. We reaffirm that we have no other obligation in life except to try to make it better for the group coming behind us. And we reaffirm that we've got to do that working with women, working with organizations, working in our community, and standing up as men. And then something called reclamation sits in, which is what Congresswoman Holmes Norton and I were talking about earlier, where you've decided unitarily that you're going to reclaim your spirit, your dignity, your honor, your grace, your personhood, and that no matter what's going on in this nation, nothing will take that away from you. So when you see men turning out all across the nation, leading these marches, being a part of community activities to bring about a sense of justice, they are reclaiming for themselves in a little bit of time that all of us may have left, a sense of dignity that cannot and ought not be stripped away. For a race of people who have suffered, endured, and survived 3 centuries of slavery, oppression, deprivation, degradation, denial, and disprivilege, we see things through a different lens. And we say to the nation and to others, walk a mile in my shoes before you judge me. And if you see the same things that I see, work with me to change the nation so that we prevent the tragedies. And until we do that, we're not going to go very far. We can't ignore what's going on. The men I know will not ignore it. And many of the women who stand by them and support them will not ignore it. So the question is, do we revisit this in 20 years? Is this a 22-year Rodney King reaffirmation? What's going on? Was it Emmett Till in 55 and something else in 79 and Rodney King in 93 and Trayvon Martin now? We can't keep revisiting this. We cannot do it, and we ought not. Thank you very much, sir.
Now I know why we miss Quincy. It's only so much in the Congress. Thank you very much. We're going to ask the chairs and the vice chairs to ask questions first. We're going to ask you to make your question maybe a minute and a half so that answers can come. I have a list here, the order of members arrival. Let me begin with a question for Mr. Martin or others. To be candid, I have been in search of a tangible legacy for Trayvon Martin. This hearing, this event, is an example, but it will pass. And I'd like to see how you see the channeling of all that energy out there. Of course, everyone's focused on the Justice Department. That may or may not be in our hands. Some are saying major organizations should decide whether they're going to go to Florida which has stand your ground laws, and are asking that people not take their conventions and their money to Florida. Mr. Crump said, the police essentially can't profile, can a civilian profile? Well, the reason that, if you can catch them, the reason that the police can't profile is because that's state action. A civilian is not state action. And the answer, Mr. Crump, is that a civilian can profile if you are in a stand-your-ground state. So another tangible legacy that occurs to me is, why are we going to let these stand-your-ground laws stand? They are a clear and present danger to every black man in America. Those are two things that occur to me. Now, I'm going to ask the panel, beginning with Mr. Martin himself, if he's given any thought to a tangible legacy of any kind, leave aside these suggestions of any kind, so that that energy won't dissipate within the next month and we go on to something else.
I think that the energy that we're going to channel into this discussion is very simple. As American citizens, we can't stand by and let a not guilty verdict dictate what our youth legacy becomes. I think 50 years from now, when I'm dead and gone, I would like to see that Trayvon Martin name is attached to some type of statute or amendment that says you can't simply profile our children, shoot them in the heart, kill them, and say that you were defending yourself. And 50 years from now, it won't be just Trayvon Martin. This will be kids and communities all across this country. And so, as I said, the question is, what can we do as parents? What can we do as African-American men to assure our kids that you don't have to be afraid to walk outside your house, go to the store, get a bag of Skittles, a can of iced tea, and not make it home? The next time your parents see you, you're dressed in white in the funeral. That's something that no parent should have to ever go through. And I think it's with everything that I have left in me, we're going to try to make sure that his name won't be dragged through the mud, that his legacy will be Trayvon helped bridge the gap of America. So I think that's something that we're working hard at. And even with all of the obstacles that are thrown at us, we think that with the help of Congress, of the CBC, I think that we can make tremendous strides in this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to Mr. Mfumi. You mentioned that you were working with 700 college students who were struggling. Suppose these were 700 14, 15-year-old African-American boys. What would you tell them about growing up, further development, they can play?
That's a very good question, Congressman. I know that the first thing that I would tell them, no matter where they're from and what they came through, that it's really not how you start in life, it's how you finish. And that we all have a birth date and a dash and a death date, but the dash determines how we lived, what we did, what we believed, and what contributions we make. So when I incidentally work with young African-American men, and I want to commend all the organizations around the country that are doing this day in and day out without a lot of fanfare, is to try to give them a sense of pride, a sense of purpose, a sense of commitment. They've got to know their history to begin with, because if you don't know where you've been from, you will have no idea. They've got to learn basic values if they don't have them. Many already do, and I mentioned before, work hard, play by the rules, respect your elderly. And we've got to just fire up an innate belief that's in all children, that they can be whatever they want to be, they can do whatever they want to do, they can do great things, and they themselves are great people. Oftentimes, they get suppressed in this society, and then you get issues of esteem and things like that. Our job is to take the lid off of that and to allow their spirits to soar and to work with them day in and day out, because, and this is, this, I don't mean this as a slant to any woman anywhere, because I was raised by a woman. But some of you know that the quickest route to a young black man is through an older black man. And when you get in front of him, look him dead in the eye, and speak from your heart, there's a kind of connection there that doesn't allow for a lot of wavering. Our kids still need that. We all got that from somebody who just got right up in our face, and we knew they cared about us. And I can't explain, I really can't explain it, except it's a different kind of connection that keeps black men, young kids, I should say, I think, on a greater course. And I say that again with all due respect, because I was raised by a woman, and yet it was a man that grabbed me one day and said, look, you're going to do what your mother said, you're going to do what your family said, and you're going to be somebody no matter what. So it doesn't matter that I was, as I was then, a high school dropout, a teenage parent, arrested 13 times before the age of 19. What connected with me was, that's something I never felt before, and I'm getting it straight and unfiltered. So there's a lot to do with young men and young women. Trust me, I appreciate all the comments that I've heard about that. But that's where I would start. And I think you've got to start with the root and the basics, and you've got to start with love.
We've been joined by Representative Cedric Wilson and Richmond, I'm sorry. It is Vice Chair Wilson has suggested that before we come to her for a question, we ask Vice Chair Richmond whether he has a question.
I do, and then I would just quickly say to the last comment from Mr. Fume, who was my commencement speaker at Morehouse, by the way, I went to one of the best public schools in the country. And then when people ask me who was my mentor, my favorite teacher, it was a guy named Greg Bryant, who happened to be the head custodian. But he was a strong black man who found me every day to make sure that I was doing right and that I set high expectations, or he had high expectations for me so that I can reach it. And I guess my question, this tragedy is unspeakable. You can't start a fight and then claim self-defense when you lose. But what we do as members of Congress is we enact policy, we make laws, and we should set priorities for spending in this country. And the White House should do the same. So my question to you all would be, as members of Congress and looking at the plight of our black men and boys, from mandatory minimum sentences to expulsion rates to all of those things, if what is it you would like to see in terms of Congress or the White House in dealing with this issue? And it's hard for other people to understand. And maybe my anger is a little bit more than other people, because I think I did a bunch of things right in life to get to where I am. But when I'm home, and sometimes when I'm on an elevator in this building without a member pin, I'm still just a young black dude that probably is not supposed to be here. So how do we invest resources? How do we pump that into our communities and raise those expectations for our young black males and give them that sense of self-worth? And deal with the anger at the same time, that when someone does that to me, I can't act out. I have to do like Jackie Robinson did on 42 and suck it up and take it in this day and age, even though I'm a member of Congress and the person that's treating me like that most of the time is not. You have to take it. So That's my question. What do we do as members of Congress to help with all those things?
I will just speak to the Stand Your Ground laws, Congressman Richmond. I think last time we were at this panel, it was suggested that you control the purse strings. I think it was Congressman Conyers' committee to document the statistical data of how this Stand Your Ground law is being applied. And when it is blacks as the victims, the defendants or killers, are they exonerated? And when it is blacks who are claiming Stand Your Ground, are we exonerated? I think President Obama asked that question rhetorically if Trayvon was of age and would have had a gun and defended himself against a strange man who was following him, would he have been able to claim Stand Your Ground? So I think that is a question that you all have the power to really get that statistical analysis before the world and say, if it's not being applied fairly, then we're going to look at how we give out the financial allocations to the states that have these Stand Your Ground. That may be one start, because everybody has concluded that it is so arbitrary how this law is being applied. As, you know, the sister in Jacksonville who got convicted for 20 years.
Sir, I have three responses about things that I'd love to work with the members of the Congressional Black Caucus on behalf of the White House Initiative. The first is to invest in early education. It should come as no surprise. What we know is that for every single dollar we invest in high-quality early learning, we can expect a return of anywhere from $7 to $13. It simply does not make sense that we waste money every year on attempting to remediate our students when we can start early and invest and ensure that they make solid steps that will ensure that they're on solid ground for the course of their lifetime. The second area is recruiting and better preparing educators. This can also be applied to individuals who represent the criminal justice system. We need to ensure that every adult who is in front of children, regardless of their phenotype or their genotype, sees them as young people and understands how to put in the work required to meet them where they are, with high expectations and with love, and to support them in exceeding their dreams. We can also make a concerted investment in recruiting more African-American teachers and African-American male teachers in particular. Men in particular comprise fewer than 2% of all educators across this country. And so when we talk about stigma, that has everything to do with how it is that non-African-American teachers view African-American boys. And a footnote here is that this isn't just a black-white problem, right? It's often been said that all my skinfolk ate my kinfolk, so we need to have a national conversation about race and how it is that we see our kids in these systems. And then the third thing we can do is focus on fatherhood. As the youngest man on this panel, sir, your comportment and grace has been meaningful to me in ways that I still don't fully realize. And it's important for us to acknowledge the relationship that this man has with his sons, both of them, and to talk about and to create opportunities for other men to be present in the lives of young men, men who have familial relationships and men who are just there because they care. We need to talk about how it is that we better provide opportunities for men to be formally engaged in school. Sometimes when brothers come out of the correctional facility, there are barriers that inhibit them from being involved in their children's lives. We need to have those conversations, and we need to do the work to make sure that those barriers don't exist. Those are but three things that come to mind, and there's a whole lot more. I look forward to doing the work.
Mm-hmm. And I chime in on that, those excellent points, and Attorney Crump, that the employment situation is pretty devastating for young black men and for young black adults. One out of two black men in New York is unemployed. There's not that many lazy people in America, right? So that the stigma is you just don't want to work. There just ain't no jobs. And when we look at the disproportionate employment among African-American people in general, and when we begin to disaggregate the data and the categories and begin to see in those subcategories that black men and boys have not been introduced into a world of work, what do you lose from that? You lose how to get up on time, how to set your alarm clock, how to go get that paycheck, how to show up and be rewarded, because there's nothing more thrilling, well, very few things, than having done a job well done for your employer to understand that, and for you most especially, to know that you did an honest day's work and you got paid and you were counted as worthy. And so behind all of these statistics about escalating black unemployment, we got to deal with that. And we have to be unafraid to target that, right? Because we know that look, you don't go to the hospital to get medicine. If you've got cancer, you get chemotherapy. If you've got a hangnail, you get an aspirin. If you've got diabetes, you get insulin. So no such thing as one tide lifts all boats. You've got to have targeted, specific medicine for the ills at hand. And we have to be unafraid in this culture to say that American citizens who happen to be black need the bully pulpit of Congress in terms of the laws that you can create, enhancing that. When I was a kid, CETA and Neighborhood Youth Corps, let me tell you, man, that was just big stuff. Because I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and we had tremendous and escalating rates of crime and social hostility introduced into the fabric of our existence that rent it apart, and yet the ability to work was extremely important. And then secondly, these neighborhood block grants, I mean, you know, to be able to buffer and sustain local communities, and the president was a community organizer. This is the kind of stuff he knows like the back of his hand. And many people in Congress have been, you know, involved from that world before becoming politicians. So I think the enhancing of that is extremely important. And then these, thirdly, the fatherhood initiatives shouldn't just be a lecture about how you should be a better daddy, but it should be about resources to enable us to be better fathers. I was a teen father. I had to go to court to even see my son when they said black men don't even want to see their children. And I had to force the state to allow me the opportunity to rear my son, who's now 35 years old, Morehouse graduate like you. So to me, that's extremely important for us not just to stigmatize, especially black fathers, because most non-resident fathers are involved in the lives of their children, statistically speaking, but we don't hear about that. And then finally, you ask, what can the White House do? I think the White House can set the tone. I think that when the president spoke the other day, because he's calm, he's rational, he's reasonable, he says it in a charming, majestic, magnificent, mellifluous manner, that communicates the kind of anger and passion that is righteous in this country that should be articulated, but he translates that into a tone that others may be able to hear. But we need more, not less of it. I know he was being humble when he said, look, politicians can't lead that. Lead. I know he said politicians can't be involved in this. Be involved. Because as the president of the United States of America, your skin speaks before your mouth opens. The authority and dignity you possess as the most powerful person in the world gives you a leverage. And just as the president has been unafraid to go to Morehouse and to challenge those black men in public, be unafraid to stand before the rest of America and challenge them too, so that now we have an equivalence between the bully pulpit of the White House and the authority of that magnificent office for Mr. Obama to say, these are the stakes. And not simply in terms of defending black people, I think white brothers and sisters have to come to grips with a couple of three things as well. First of all, I teach at majority white institutions. Ignorance, unintelligence, inarticulateness, and wanting to be cool ain't got no copyright in black communities, number one. Number two, drugs are being done on every campus. I don't want to name the present campus where I reside. No drugs at all exist there. But every other campus I've been on, they got meth labs. White kids in college, meth labs. Don't go to jail. Don't get stigmatized. So that you're being penalized because of the fact that the crime is done on the campus, you don't get subject to if it's on the crack house. And then thirdly, we've got to disabuse white America of the notion that our kids and your kids are so much different. We all want the same thing. And if the president could stand up and remind America that he's not the only person who is brilliant and bold and eloquent and articulate, that there are millions more yet still that you know nothing about, and that he has the power at least to educate and challenge. And I know some people say, hey, it's hard when the president speaks on race. He takes a hit on everything. He takes a hit on jobs bills. He's out there right now at Knox College trying to tell the truth about the economy. He takes a hit for everything. This will be another hit, but it's one that will impact the larger society as well. I think those things would be critical.
So Vice Chair Wilson is going to ask a question. We're going to try to get as many questions in before people go to vote and ask people to come back from voting.
Yeah. Congresswoman, could I, if down here at the table, if I could just have a second to respond, because I want to thank Brother Richmond for his pointed question, which was, what can we as a congressional body do specifically? And I've got three things, sir, and I'll be very succinct. Number one, I think there ought to be a Trayvon Martin law, which is an anti-stand-your-ground federal piece of legislation which would supersede state laws the way federal legislation does in certain instances, that makes it illegal to profile, pursue, accost, and then eventually kill somebody. And so that, a Trayvon Martin law that goes to the heart of that, I think, deals with a number of issues on this stand your ground thing. The second thing, if the caucus in its own way, particularly through the Judiciary Committee, could look at mandatory minimums in an even more broader way, and I'm sure Brother Conyers will look at that, that gives us some direction as to where there ought to be federal legislation to change those, because it does away with discretion for judges, and then ultimately black kids. Let me just say this. You poor black, you poor white, you poor Latino, mandatory minimums hurt you. And then the third thing, if the caucus in its own way could consider an urban Marshall Plan that is not new spending, because that's what the critics will say immediately, but an urban Marshall Plan that would direct existing resources and existing appropriations toward urban investment and employment, and in education and other things, so that we're not asking for new money, but to direct the money through the appropriation process, which is a critical process, to how it ought to be spent, where it ought to be applied. I think those things will help at least alleviate some of this. And I want to also acknowledge Congresswoman Waters, who is good to see and a real fighter, and thank you for being here as well. Thank you.
All right, next. Lacey Clay, we were going to take you next.
Thank you so much, and let me thank the panel for being here, and also let me say to Tracy Martin, as a representative of the of your hometown of St. Louis and East St. Louis, Illinois, our prayers are with you, and our support is behind you. I want you to know that. Let me get to the point that Dr. Dyson brought up, and so did Mr. Johns, about the educational system. It seems as though our educational system has done a disservice to our kids. And you pointed out some great points about what we need to do as far as teacher training and teacher diversity. I've been involved with education for about 30 years as part of a scholarship fund, and we push young black men into those scholarships. I'm also a father of a 12-year-old son, and it's been some tough weeks these last 2 weeks, explaining to him our history, going over it, and preparing him for manhood. So I know what you're going through, Mr. Martin. Dr. Dyson, should we take control at the local level of school districts, or should we blow it up and start over with the whole educational process here? I mean, if it's doing such a disservice to our young people, where do we go?
Yes, sir.
And I just want to acknowledge, when you said you had a 12-year-old son, I'm sure most of America, you became an instant hero for them in many ways. And to speak about that child, the reality is, look, the school system is pretty buffeted by several forces. Dwindling resources, a tax base that determines how much resource you get. You could be in the suburb where children get twice as much money per capita, per student, as a student in the inner city. We know this, right? So that the defunding of institutions where in some schools you got big, shiny new computers, you got access to the internet that's high speed, and then in the inner city you got second, third-hand books that still say Richard Nixon, as Jonathan Kozol famously said, is still the president. So, first of all, we got to close the disparity in the resource base and generate alternative structures of funding where people who are interested, corporations who are interested, organizations who are interested, institutions who are interested, begin to fund and invest in urban education. Because everybody can't go, as great a school as Jeffrey Canada has, ain't but so many people can go, and then it's a lottery. So what do the people who can't go feel like? Like, I don't even win that lottery. That's number one. Number two, I think that, yes, the investment and involvement at the local level, where school boards, teachers, principals, and parents become much more invested and creative. I mean, some of the things that Mr. Johns and Congressman Mfume were saying are extremely critical, and they can happen on the local level with creative teachers. And, you know, a lot of teachers in our schools spend their own money for supplies and to do interesting things with their students. If a McDonald's or a Pepsi Cola or, you know, some other institution or commercial interest that black people have invested in would return the favor, redirect the capital, and adopt schools. I know some of that is going on, but to adopt these schools, we could bring that interesting and powerful resource base. And then thirdly, the investment on the local level in terms of controlling some of the curricula, or at least making contributions to make sure that when they meet with local school boards, that adequate preparation for their children is going on, and that those who are informed, those who are responsible informing those kids are themselves sensitive. A lot of kids are subject to teachers who have no idea about what their lives are and have, unfortunately, a negative impact.
Let me quickly get to Mr. Mfume and just as a follow-up, ask you, Mr. Mfume, does taking control of our children's education break up the pipeline to prison of our children?
Every documented survey suggests when there's real educational intervention, there is a corresponding decrease of those persons who ultimately end up in some way or another brushing up against the criminal justice system or going to jail. The earlier the intervention, statistics show, the greater the possibility of that. So early childhood education, what we do before and during those early years is important. Some of this, you know, as I said before, really gets down to parenting, making sure you tell your kids the right thing and the right way to be. And then, unfortunately, circumstances like this, even with that, get out of control. So there is a parenting side to this. There is a oversight side to make sure that resources are, in fact, going in. And that's why I talked about directing existing appropriations without creating any new bill, which everybody would say we don't need. But we do need direction so that those schools that are doing that early intervention are funded, held accountable, and make a difference.
Just a moment, Mr. Martin and Mr. Crump need to leave to catch a plane. And so I'm going to excuse them and ask others to remain, and as many members.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed the program at the Black Caucus July 24th meeting at the Trayvon Martin case. And the sponsors of our show, Reality Sports Group of Rosa, Virginia, and New England former magazine Tory Way, CEO of Basketball Massachusetts, CY Frozen Market, CDR Liberty Street, Elsewhere, California, 510-235-1233. Michael Lewis Ingram, BSN, Social Radio, The Raw. every Saturday 11 to 1 to the 4 Eastern Time. Number 718-508-9216. Okay, Gazelle Patrol. And my second home, WCLM 1450. And WCLMRadioOnline.com. We got my ready. It will be on WCLM last 2 weeks of this month. Roll Rogers, CEO of BSN, New York City, New York. And Pat Freeman, the mighty Oba, from WUFO, 1080, Buffalo, New York. You can join us, the Gold Caravan, the Soul Patrol, Bad Nation, WCLM, on Facebook.com. Get your articles at BlackAddy.com. And to get a different look at sports, I'd like to thank Seeds Van, their video library, and the Congressional Black Caucus on African American Men in America. Today, particularly Gerald Martin and the Martin case, how we protect our young black men. Next week, we will discuss what this show will produce, the emails and the chat room. Next week, we will discuss all the questions. Hope you enjoyed the show. We're out of here for today. Hope you have a good weekend. Stay dry in the east. And stay cool in the west. Good night.
Hi, this is Kathleen of The Kathleen Wells Show. We've been on a full year, and it's been a fabulous run, and you're going to want to join us. In fact, right now, we're doing a series called Voices from Palestine. My executive producer, Donna Nassour, she's in the Middle East, and she's conducting interviews right now with Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinians in Bethlehem, Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And those interviews will be played on my show. So you're going to want to join us Wednesday from 2 to 3 on KCAA right here to hear Voices from Palestine. You don't want to miss it. Join me.
Tune into One Love Radio on Wednesdays at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time with your hosts, Rhonda Harper and Imani Wilmot, on blogtalkradio.com.
If you're looking for real talk on sports, politics, and other important issues, tune in to The Bachelor Pad every Monday through Friday beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. L.A. Bachelor and Tony McClain look to enlighten, empower, and educate people on the topics that people are talking about, but discuss them from a social, economical, and racial standpoint. It's sports, breaking news, updates, politics, great guests, and music in between. It's The Bachelor Pad every Monday through Friday beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen at www.thebachelorpad.biz. That's www.thebachelorpad.biz. Follow us at facebook.com/padnation and at Pad for Truth on Twitter. That's at Pad4Truth.
Check out In Our Opinion with Southern Eagle and Steel City Storm each Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, dude, stop with the lectures, stop with the threats. Be a human being, let the guy go up there and say goodbye, for God's sake.
Rick Pocket is another one. He pounded me probably about 4 or 5 times in my career. I never want to fight Cam Neely, never want to fight.
And I knew what the power guy possessed. Well, I could tear a man's ear off. Again, only in theory because never done it yet.
How do you punish an Amish kid? Make him watch TV for 2 hours?
Sports talk. The way it was meant to be.
BlackAthlete.com.
Looking for the definitive source for information? BlackAthlete.com, that's where it's at. From Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, to Michael Jordan and Shaq, football, basketball, baseball, and everything in between. We focus on all the major players and stories, daily features, video on demand, and Black Athlete newspapers coming to a city near you. Tired of the same old sports programming? Check out BlackAthlete.com. Sports the way you like it.